This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. It might surprise you to learn that the percentage of teenagers who are sexually active is quite a bit lower today than it was back in the 1980s. A report out this month from the Centers for Disease Control shows that fewer than half of young women and men ages 15 to 19 are sexually active. However, the pregnancy rate in the United States is still a lot higher than in other wealthy nations. It's estimated that 3 out of 10 adolescent women in this country become pregnant. This hour, we talk about teens and contraception. In this age of information, is the message getting across? Which are the most effective methods for adolescents, and how accessible are they? We'll also take a look at a program in Colorado which has cut the rate of teen births by a huge number, 40%, by offering long-acting contraception to young people. That's coming up in just a bit. But first, we get an overview on teens and contraceptive use from Ann Titelman, Associate Professor of Nursing at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing. Ann, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And Mary Ott is Associate Professor of Pediatrics and Adolescent Medicine at the University of Indiana School of Medicine. Mary, great to have you here.
Thanks. I'm delighted to be here also.
So the percentage of teenage women who are sexually active has dropped, but for those who are having sex, the pregnancy rate is still high. And let's go to you first. Why is that?
Well, it's obviously many factors that go into that. One is teens are often not seeking reproductive health care early enough, and so they're taken off guard when the situation comes up. They may not be talking to their parents or providers or getting adequate information still. We think there's a lot of good information out there, but there's a lot of teens who are still not being reached with that information. Sex ed in schools has been on decline. Our public education system has been eliminating extra programs. So sex ed is one of the things that can go, and often in public education settings, attendance is somewhat irregular. So if you miss the one class on contraception, you've missed it for that year or that entire high school education. So those are some of the reasons. That are going on.
Okay, let's talk about contraceptive methods. Many young people are using, according to the CDC report, 60% of teen couples have opted at times for withdrawal, which, of course, can be ineffective. Mariotte, are you surprised?
I'm not surprised. We typically think of withdrawal as a non-method. It actually has it's a method with a low level of effectiveness. I think a lot of the things that Anne just spoke about in terms of decreases in comprehensive sex education, issues around lack of access to contraceptives have resulted in young people using withdrawal as a method.
Okay. So what are some of the answers then immediately? We'll get back to the contraceptives in a moment, specific contraceptives, but and what do you think? What are some of the answers as far as access and information for teens?
I think one encouraging trend is I do think there is a lot of good information around reproductive health and sexual health on the web, and I think teens are accessing that more. So that's something we could develop more and strengthen. I think we've seen a drop in the teen pregnancy rate, partly because there's been a greater concern around reproductive health in general, around the HIV epidemic and sexually transmitted infections. In part, that's also been spurred by the HPV vaccine, which now gets introduced to young teens initially and may be sparking a conversation between providers and parents earlier on. Those are all good trends I see that are happening. One thing that is interesting, though, is that the teen birth rate does vary quite a bit across our country. And as you said, it is the highest birth rate of any industrialized country. But within the United States, that birth rate is quite variable. So there can be states like Mississippi and New Mexico with birth rates that are 3 times higher than states like in New England, of Massachusetts and New Hampshire. This comes from a report by economists, and they analyzed this data, and they found that women, adolescents coming from lower income families, but also living in areas where there was a great deal of economic inequality. So they are linking a lack of opportunity for young women for future opportunities to advance socially and economically in their communities as a link to helping us unravel this problem around teen pregnancy.
And so a lack of access to information as well through schools,
right,
and perhaps because of economic disadvantage, a lack of access to the internet?
No, they're just choosing early childbearing to sort of go on with the next phase of their life because the social and economic opportunities presented to them are limited. And they see that as an opportunity to grow and develop their family and take a next step into adulthood. And that's a marker of that. And so without other options for social and economic development, having a child seems like the next step one would do.
Okay. Well, I'd like to bring a quote from Isabel Sawhill, an economist at the Brookings Institution, into the conversation. She says, if we want to reduce poverty, one of the simplest, fastest, and cheapest things we could do would be to make sure as few people as possible become parents before they actually want to. And she argues in one of her books that single parenthood is a principal driver of inequality. That's a pretty strong statement. Marriott, principal driver of inequality.
I think there are, so it's very clear that early parenthood is associated with poor outcomes, particularly poor social and educational and economic outcomes, not just for the parent, but for the child. So we see this association. And this is one of the reasons why the Academy of Pediatrics, as well as the CDC and our gynecology practice organization, ACOG, have emphasized access to long-acting reversible contraceptives. So the association is clearly there, and the solution in turn is also, you know, helping these young women delay sex. One piece of that is access to contraceptives. One piece of that is going to be along the lines of what Anne is talking about in terms of thinking more broadly, thinking about adolescent development and health disparities in relationships. One of the things you'll see adolescent doctors do is talk less about sex and more about healthy relationships, because sex is a really funny kind of risk factor. We want teens to delay having sex, but we also want them to ultimately be sexually healthy adults. And to become a sexually healthy adult, young people have to learn about relationships, learn about what's involved in a healthy relationship. And one piece of that is contraception and safety. So I think, you know, sort of thinking about sex less as a risk and more about sex and relationships as part of normal development. And then that shifts the focus to a focus just on rates of sex, to thinking about focusing on healthy relationships and a part of healthy relationships being having access to contraception if young people do have sex.
And Anne, I wanted to pick up on something that I think you alluded to a little bit earlier, and that is that some young women actually look forward to bearing children. Am I getting that right? It's kind of as a next step in their growth. If that is the case, then how do you dissuade them from that step?
Well, with limited options, that may seem more attractive. Mm-hmm. But I think the opportunities that are presented then need to, you know, to try to keep someone in school longer, to offer support for community college, to offer work programs that will get them on a track for productive employment. Those are some of the ways that can spur that along. And it's a little bit like a chicken and egg. I mean, the economics fuel teen pregnancy, and teen pregnancy keeps women on a downward spiral trajectory in terms of their future possibilities. So it's, I think, attacking it at both ends is really important. And so the contraception is an important piece, and access is a very important piece, and long-acting reversible contraceptives are also very important, but it's part of a larger picture.
And the conversation is important.
The conversation
with these young people.
Right.
We're going to address long-acting contraceptives and a very interesting program in Colorado in just a few minutes here on Radio Times. But let's get back to, again, the CDC report for a moment and methods that young people are using. 97% of teenage girls who are sexually active have tried condoms, which is good if you're trying to prevent sexually transmitted disease, but not necessarily pregnancy. Marriott, would you like to address that?
I have to also say that those numbers aren't as optimistic as they sound because condom use requires effective pregnancy and STD prevention requires proper use of a condom every single time an individual has sex. When we look at the Youth Risk Behavior Survey, which is a survey given to high school students by the CDC, they found that actually only 59% of kids used a condom during their most recent sexual intercourse. So while 97% have ever used a condom at least once, a much lower percentage of them are using condoms appropriately. So I think that it's one of these numbers that we need to dig into a little bit with that.
And as far as sexually transmitted disease is concerned, if you're going to be sexually active, am I correct in saying that you need to use a condom each and every time out? And entitlement?
Yes, absolutely. That's important. I don't want to take us off track, but there's a new pill that one can take every day, pre-exposure prophylaxis, to help prevent HIV acquisition. That is just coming out as recommendations from the CDC for particularly high-risk groups, but that takes us a little off track into the STI HIV world. But up until recently, condoms were the main way to prevent STIs and HIV, which are also very, very high among teenagers, highest among teens of all age groups and highest among girls than boys.
Hmm. Use of the morning after pill has more than doubled, apparently, since it was made available over the counter to all teens. And Bill Albert of the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy says this shows that teens, like adults, often are not very good at contraception. In the battle between sex and sex with contraception, sex often wins. Marriott, I guess this rings true with kids?
I think that I would probably go to Bill's comment and say that it's probably true for almost everyone. It also sort of brings us back to the piece that it's really hard to do to use a medication that you have to take it each and every day, or to use a method that you use every single time. And which is why we are encouraging young people to move towards long-acting reversible methods, so the implant and the IUD. The other piece, part of that statistic, I have to say, is I find it actually very hopeful because I think that it's a very responsible behavior.
Mary, I'm going to have to stop you for a second because we're up against a break. We will talk about a program in Colorado coming right up after the break. This is Radio Times. Stay with us. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowane. Fewer sexually active teenagers are giving birth or having abortions in Colorado. Since 2009, health officials have conducted an experiment. If teens and poor women were offered long-acting contraception, implants, or intrauterine devices, would they choose to use them? The response was huge, and the rate of teen births has plunged about 40%. Here to tell us more about the program is Greta Klingler, supervisor of the Family Planning Unit for the Colorado Department of Health. Welcome, Greta.
Hi, Mary. Good to be here this morning.
Good to have you here. And staying with us for the full hour, Ann Teitelman, Associate Professor of Nursing at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing, and Mary Ott, Associate Professor of Pediatrics and Adolescent Medicine at the University of Indiana School of Medicine. So, Greta, tell us how this program came about.
Back in 2008, we received a large private grant to really enhance a program that was already existing here in Colorado. The state health department receives federal Title X funding, which is the federal family planning money, as well as state general funds to support family planning services throughout the state. Most of our clinics are in local public health departments, and they tend to serve primarily very low-income women, although we serve anybody who comes in the door. And we serve a lot of teens. And we knew there was an issue with accessing the most effective forms of contraceptives, long-acting reversible devices like IUDs and contraceptive implants. And primarily it was because of the high upfront cost. Our clinics offer services on a sliding fee scale that goes to zero. And when 90% of our clients slide to zero and can't pay anything, it's hard to cover devices that have an upfront cost of somewhere between $300 and $800, depending on where you are. And so we took this money and really aimed to reduce the barriers. So we focused heavily on provider and clinic staff training and then removing the cost barrier for patients, allowing them to choose these methods just like they've had access to all of the other methods in our clinics, like pills, patches, Depot, mm-hmm. the ring.
So why these particular forms of birth control as opposed to, say, the pill?
We know from studies that, one, they're more effective, and it's largely because there's not that room for user error. People don't have to remember to take a pill every day or change your ring once a month or come back every 3 months for a shot at the clinic. And removing that user error really means that they're about 20 times as effective in real life as birth control pills are. And we felt like we were doing a disservice to our clients by not being able to offer the best possible methods out there.
So are there any potential negatives associated with long-acting reversible contraceptives? Mariette, let's bring you back into the conversation.
These are medical devices. But they're largely safe. There is a very, very, for the IUDs, there's a small, very, very small risk of uterine perforation. There's a small risk of the device coming out. Young women can have irregular bleeding on them. They can have some discomfort. Having said that, when we're using them for pregnancy prevention, all of these devices and all contraceptives are much safer than pregnancy. When we think about sort of like blood clots and birth control pills, your risk of blood clots is much, much higher with pregnancy than it is with birth control pills. And it's sort of similar with the IUDs and implants. They are medical devices, but they're largely safe, relatively safe medical devices. The rates of complications are very low, and when we're thinking about preventing something like pregnancy, when we think about like a safety sort of weighing risk of pregnancy versus use of a device, the device comes up much higher on the safety comparison.
And Greta Klingler, you were going to say?
I would echo exactly what Mary said. I think we often forget that while pregnancy is a natural, healthy occurrence for so many women, it does come with risks. And that even when there's side effects or other concerns with birth control, they're much lower than they would be with pregnancy. And I would say one of the things we learned was, of course, you know, all methods come with side effects, both good and bad. And having our clinicians be able to counsel patients around what to expect and how to manage some of those side effects if necessary was really key to making the program successful and making sure that people were satisfied with the method that they were choosing.
How much does a program like this cost to implement?
For the first several years, we received about $5 million a year, and it's tapered off over the past 3 years. And we anticipate that within the next couple of years, our clinics will be able to sustain this through long-term funding sources from Medicaid and insurance, kind of realized through the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid expansion here in Colorado.
And what are the cost benefits, Greta?
The cost benefits are huge. In a preliminary study, we looked at the number of births averted to the Medicaid population, and we estimate that in the first 3 years of the program, the state saved about $80 million in Medicaid costs, and that was just looking at prenatal costs for the woman that would have occurred, labor and delivery, and first-year health costs for the infant. It didn't take into account anything beyond that.
And so, Greta Klingler, were you surprised at the huge drop in the rate of teen births and also abortions, both at about 40%?
You know, I think we all were. When we first started, everybody knew, I think, that there would be positive outcomes. But when the data started coming in, and seeing how dramatically things were changing. I think we were all a little surprised.
And so what next for this program? Do you expect to expand its reach?
Our initial private funding has ended, and as I said, our clinics have done a great job of kind of reaching a new point of sustainability and accessing other funding streams. But we know there's a lot of work that remains to be done here in Colorado with training other providers and making sure that barriers in other health systems are decreased as well. So we hope through either additional state funding or some new private funding that we may be able to expand beyond the existing network that we've worked with.
Okay. Greta Klingler joining us for a few minutes here on Radio Times to give us some insight into Colorado's birth control program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Greta is supervisor of the Family Planning Unit for the Colorado Department of Health. Ann Teitelman, if you would, review for us the advantages of delaying a first pregnancy until the age of 24.
The advantages are many. It allows a young woman to finish her education or get far enough along in her education, establish herself in a career. The other part of it is something that Marriott was alluding to earlier, which is being more experienced and knowledgeable about relationships and being able to have mature and healthy conversations with a partner, getting to know someone and getting to know how they make decisions before having sex, and thereby being more prepared, having more time to go seek a reproductive health care and get that information and understand it. So there are many reasons that that are an advantage, and it puts her on a good trajectory for her future social and economic opportunities.
We have a Facebook comment from Patty who says, sadly, the states that need this most, where teen pregnancy rates are highest, are the ones least likely to implement it. Is there a correlation, Ann, in your opinion?
Least likely to implement, like the Colorado experiment, or
I'm guessing that what she—that's what she means.
Right.
Or educational programs,
right,
et cetera.
I think that speaks to the importance of our federal programs, like our Title X Family Planning Program, which offers low-income reproductive health care. Reproductive health care for low-income women and teenagers. And covers all states, and that's a very important program that we need to, you know, has been doing this kind of work for many, many years and has been a major contributor to the reduction in unintended pregnancy among teenagers and adults. And I also want to mention that not all teen pregnancies are unintended. About 80% are, about 20% are intended. We're seeing the bulk of those teen pregnancies in the older age group among the 18, 19-year-olds, about 73% are among, and that's been shifting upwards, too, so that's a good change, 73% among 18 to 19-year-olds. About 50% of adult pregnancies are unintended, and the vast majority of unintended pregnancies are among adults. So we forget that when we think about this teen pregnancy rate, so mm-hmm. that good access to contraception and information and services is important for teens, but also for all women of reproductive age.
And with the teens who do intend to become pregnant and have children, do you find they have committed partners?
Not necessarily. One of the major predictors of being a teen mom is having a teen mom. And also living in a household at the age of 14 where there were not both biological parents present in the household. So if a child grows up in a house without a partner, her female offspring and male offspring are more likely to be teen parents themselves.
Let's get back to contraception. And Marriott, back into the conversation here. The birth control pill, about half of the sexually active teenage girls surveyed in the CDC report say they are using the pill. Bring us up to speed, if you would. There are some brands which are safer than others. Am I correct? There's been a little bit of controversy, I think, about a couple which use synthetic progesterone. Is that an issue, Mary?
Yeah. There are small differences in birth control pills based on the synthetic. The birth control pills have two hormones in them. One of them is an estrogen-based hormone. Most of them use something called a thionyl estradiol, but most of them use the same estrogen hormone. And then they have a progesterone hormone in it, and there are many different progesterone hormones. Most of the risk of blood clots, which is the big negative consequence of birth control pills, comes from the estrogen component, and that you can roughly assess based on estrogen dose. So we mostly don't use 50 microgram pills. We use 30 or 20 microgram pills. However, there's also a small increase in clot risk based on the progesterone dose. So some types of progesterones have a little bit more clot risk than others. But the clot risk is, the difference is really small. We use this term called relative risk, and the relative risk is like compared to the standard of care, how much more risk does it bring? And like the relative risk of a lot of these methods is 1.1. So if your risk of a clot is less than 1%, a relative risk of 1.1 is like 1% is 1.1%. So it's like a really small increase in risk. So while there's been a lot of, like many of my patients will come in shocked, Dr. Ott, am I on the pill that the lawyers and television are saying is causing blood clots?
Uh-huh.
And so I get these frantic calls and visits where I stopped using the pill because my grandmother said that she saw on TV that this birth control pill could cause blood clots. And it sort of gets back to my initial point, like these are all medications and they have side effects. The risks are fairly low. And if a young person is at risk for pregnancy, the risk of clots with birth control pills is much lower than the risk of clots with pregnancy. But, they do have side effects. For pregnancy prevention, we find the side effect profile acceptable, and there are small differences. So if I have a young person who has a particular medical complication that may put her at risk for blood clots, I'll be very careful to look at the progesterone in her pills and look at what type of method and maybe give her a method without estrogen. So it's something as a provider, if we have a medically complex young person, we'll tailor their birth control choices to their medical conditions.
Let's get to the question of contraceptives being sold over the counter, in particular the pill. In California and Oregon, women will soon be able to purchase the pill at their local pharmacy without a doctor's prescription. Is this something you're comfortable with, Marriott?
It is something that I'm comfortable with. I think the risks of birth control pills are small, and really the risks are not that much greater than other common over-the-counter medications. For instance, as a pediatrician, I've taken care of many more children with liver problems as a function of acetaminophen overdoses than I have taking care of young women with complications of birth control use. So I think the safety profile is adequate. One of the concerns that's come up a lot is, are young people able to make the decision? Do they know enough of their medical history to do that? And when we look to the adult literature, there's actually been studies looking at adult women, and can adult women give medical history on contraindications to birth control? Do they know their medical history enough to say, yeah, I've had liver problems, I shouldn't take birth control? And they found that adult women, by and large, report similar complications, similar types of contraindications, are able to identify their own contraindications the same way their physician is able to. So we actually have a study in progress at Indiana University where we're asking teens to do the same thing. We ask teens to look at a checklist of common medical contraindications to birth control use, have the teen fill out that checklist, and then we have the teen's provider fill out that checklist. We presented preliminary data in May at the North American Society for Pediatric and Adolescent Gynecology meetings, and we found that by and large, young people and physicians were concordant in their reports of medical contraindications to birth control. And when they were discordant, when there was one reporting a contraindication and the other one not, most of the cases of discordancy were the young person over-reporting
contraindication, and the young person being more likely to report it. So, for instance, we found certain types of migraines are a contraindication, and we found young people more likely to report that they had migraines than their physicians were to report that the young person had migraines. So, what we found is that young people do appear to have, our preliminary data show that young people appear to have the capacity to make these decisions. Now, these are preliminary data based on the first 60 participants. So we'll see what happens when the study finishes, but it's really promising, and it's really similar to what we see among adult women. So, my data based on and my work with teens really suggests that this could be a really positive thing, and it could give young people expanded access to birth control. So perhaps we would have fewer young people using withdrawal and more young people using birth control pills.
Ann Teitelman, just quickly before we go to the break, when we're talking about young people, I'm assuming, if it's over the counter, a 15-year-old could purchase birth control pills. But a younger person, as opposed to, say, somebody who's 19, you've got to take it every day, you've got to stay in the schedule, you've got to be responsible. Do you think that there are some young people who might be too young, really, to handle the responsibility of something like the birth control pill?
Well, I'm not sure it's so much age as much as the type of person. Like, when I prescribe birth control pills, I usually ask somebody how good are they at taking pills every day. And some say they're very good at it, and others don't. And so I think it needs to be tailored to the individual. I mean, I don't think it's so much age dependent.
Okay. We're talking about teenagers, sex, and contraception this hour. Our guests are Ann Teitelman, Associate Professor of Nursing at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing, Mary Ott, Associate Professor of Medicine at the University of Indiana School of Medicine. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 888-477-9499. More just ahead. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane, and this is Radio Times. Continuing our conversation about sexual activity, contraceptive use, and teenagers, our guests include Ann Teitelman, Associate Professor of Nursing at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing, and Mary Ott, Associate Professor of Pediatrics and Adolescent Medicine at the University of Indiana School of Medicine. And again, if you'd like to join the conversation, we'd love to hear from you. 888-477-9499 is the telephone number. An email works as well, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. And Marriott, just to conclude our conversation a bit about contraceptive birth control pills being sold over the counter in California and Oregon, we didn't mention before heading into the break that I believe that at least in one of those states, if you are purchasing the pill, you do need to have a conversation with the pharmacist. Am I correct in that? Do you know anything about that? Marriott? I'm not sure.
My understanding is that they do need to have a conversation with a pharmacist, and that also that the birth control pills will only be accessible over the counter without a prescription to those over 18 years of age, which is a similar situation that we were in with emergency contraception, where it was initially approved over the counter for individuals 18 and over. Subsequently, it's been made available over the counter to individuals of all ages. And I think one of the reasons for this increase in emergency contraceptive use among adolescents is the increase over the counter availability.
Okay. We did want to touch on the Affordable Care Act and how it covers contraceptives. Women who are covered under Obamacare technically should not have to pay for a contraception. And indeed, a Penn Medicine study has found that out-of-pocket costs fell dramatically from 2012 to 2013, down nearly 40% for the pill, for instance. Joining us with a look at the study is Nora Becker, lead author of the Penn study and a doctoral candidate at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome, Nora, to Radio Times.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Sure. So let's start with a quick look at the study. Why conduct it, and how was it done?
Sure. So as you mentioned, the Affordable Care Act says private health plans need to cover contraceptives with no cost sharing. So what we did was we looked at the we took data from a large national insurer, and we looked at the period immediately before and after this provision went into effect. And what we found was an immediate and dramatic drop in dollars paid by women. So we estimate that the average birth control pill user is now saving about $250 a year compared to what she was spending before this provision went into effect. And the average woman receiving an IUD, an intrauterine device, is saving about $250 on that insertion procedure. So these are pretty substantial savings.
So the goal under ACA is zero out-of-pocket spending for women when purchasing contraceptives. Why did this not go into effect immediately, Nora?
Sure. Well, we wouldn't actually expect to see the average price fall to completely zero. It's because what the law says is the FDA defines about 18 different categories of prescription birth control. Private health insurers are required to cover at least one brand within each of those categories with no cost sharing. So there are dozens of birth control pill brands on the market. If a woman wants to stick with a brand name that she's comfortable with that's not the one that her insurer decides to cover with no cost sharing, she can still choose to pay out of pocket for that. So, and the second reason is because not all plans in our data were yet subject to the mandate. So there's a group of plans called grandfathered plans that do not yet have to come into compliance with this provision, but those plans are being phased out. So we would expect to see average prices continue to drop over time.
Okay. Critics say there are some drawbacks to the ACA's coverage of prescription birth control. For instance, insurance premiums could rise because insurers have to fully cover the cost of contraceptives. Nora, what is your take on this?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think it's one of the big questions that we are going to want to look at in research going forward. There's really two factors here that are going to influence premium costs. The first is, how much cost savings does use of these methods produce? So for contraceptives, the cost savings they produce are tremendous. So childbirth is much more expensive than birth control itself. So if women increase their use of birth control, premiums could potentially actually go down. But the second piece is what's the magnitude of actual increase in use of birth control? And that depends on something that economists like to call price sensitivity or elasticity of demand. Basically, as the price goes down, how many more women use the product? And that's what's really unknown. How price sensitive are women for birth control? If they increase the use of birth control a lot in response to these price drops, we could actually see premiums go down. However, if they don't really change their behavior in response to these price drops, premiums could potentially increase.
And Nora Becca, let's go to a final question here. We were discussing with Ann Teitelman and Mary Ott just a few moments ago the fact that birth control pills will soon be sold over the counter in California and Oregon without a doctor's prescription. But if there's no prescription, I'm not sure if you know this at the moment, would this still be covered under ACA?
So actually, it would not. And this is actually an issue that some researchers have thought about. I don't know that there's great research on it yet when it comes to emergency contraception, which was originally prescription only and is now mostly available over the counter. Most emergency contraception available over the counter is actually not included in the Affordable Care Act mandate, which says just prescription contraceptives. So it's kind of, there's potentially this sort of two opposing, an improvement and a loss at the same time for consumers. It might be easier to get it, but they might have to pay more for it than if they went and saw their doctor and got a prescription.
Okay, Nora Becker, I'd like to thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Nora is lead author of a recent Penn Medicine study on out-of-pocket costs of contraception under the Affordable Care Act. Let's get back to some of the facts and figures. Ann Teitelman, the drop in the number of teenage boys, men, who are having sex is even more dramatic than that for young women, from 60% in 1988 to 47% in 2013. And, of course, it takes two to tango. Theories as to why, Ann?
Why fewer boys are having sex?
Mm-hmm.
I think some of the same reasons that we see for girls, the concern for HIV, the access to internet and information that way. And there's been a push to offer male reproductive health care as part of a package of good health services for adolescents. And so maybe some of that message is getting out to young men that they are also part, as you say, part of the picture, and and need to be part of that conversation and to learn about different family planning methods, different methods of contraception, have a conversation with a partner about that. So hopefully it's a very good sign that we're making some improvements in those areas.
Yeah, and this might sound a little off the wall, but then again, perhaps not. Dr. Brooke Bocar, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, adolescent medicine specialist at the Children's National Health System, says parents might want to thank smartphones. Not only, he says, are young people, or she says, young people spending a lot of time with those phones, but they're online researching sexual health and they're making more informed decisions. What do you think of that supposition, Anne?
Well, I think that's true. I don't know if it's smartphones and the generally access to the internet, but there's a lot of good information out there, and it provides teens a way to get confidential information that they might not have been getting from a parent or a provider, or maybe the not so reliable information they might have been getting from their peers. And with the decrease in access to information in the school system that we're seeing, this has been a great boon to teens to get access to this information. Much of it is very high quality. There's also some apps out there that are useful for reminders about taking contraception. The research really isn't there to say whether it's helping to remember to take a birth control pill or go back for your depot shot. We don't have that good research yet, but there's some creative uses of the of at least mobile devices in terms of augmenting contraceptive practices, which are also something we need to look into more and support.
And Marriott, what do you think of Dr. Bocor's theory?
I think, I'd have to agree with Anne that there's been a real expansion of high-quality online information. For instance, the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancies has two phenomenal websites, one called bedsider.org and another one called stayteen.org, both of which provide medically accurate and up-to-date information on contraception, healthy relationships, dating violence, deciding to wait, as well as ways to support birth control and use with birth control reminders and things like that. So there is an expansion of online information. The other thing I wanted to say is although sex rates have decreased compared to 1988, over the past 10 years, the rates of sexual activity haven't changed much, but teen pregnancy rates have continued to tick down. And one of the things one piece of this story that's really important that we haven't talked as much about are increased rates of contraceptive use and increased rates, including increased rates of more effective contraceptives. And the expansion of evidence-based sex education programs, most recently through the President's Teen Pregnancy Prevention Initiatives through the Office of Adolescent Health. So there's more of a push for evidence-based sex education and disseminating evidence-based sex education. Our experiences in St. Louis and Colorado have demonstrated that as you expand access, you can really decrease pregnancy rates.
Hmm. And at the end of the day, if possible, it's still important to get information at home as well. How do you begin entitlement? What it is, quite often an awkward conversation with your children.
Yeah, it's a good question. And when I did research a while back with teens, asking them how they learned about sex and relationships, and many talked about their family and as being a very important, and particularly their mother being a very important source of information, some of the teens said what was really particularly helpful was to hear a mother, a parent talk about experiences, not so much that the parent had, but sort of hypothetical experiences. So it might be something they're watching on TV together or a movie they went to, or somebody I know somewhere, this happened to them. And then interpret that, the good, the bad, what worked, what didn't work, and not sort of sit down with the facts and not sit down with the book, but to talk through what an example was and hear it from the parent's perspective. And often that's an easier way to have that conversation. It kind of slides in a general conversation about a movie, and it doesn't have to be the big talk. The teens just don't like the big talk.
Oh, sure. I mean, and if you can see that they're closing you down, then what do? Do you just drop it and perhaps revisit it another time?
Yeah, you just move on and try another time, yeah.
Okay, let's get to the telephones. We've got Leanne in Wynwood, Pennsylvania, standing by. Welcome to Radio Times, Leanne.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I am a registered nurse, and I guess my question is twofold, also being a parent and having friends who have older children, is how are we defining sex? We hear a lot of talk in the community that, you know, pregnancy rates, as you said, are dropping in sexual activity, but how are we defining the sexual activity? Because I think that, you know, concerns over pregnancy are leading teens to explore other avenues of sexual activity. That would be my first question. My second question is, the past year I've been doing postpartum women's health and doing home visits, and the question I have is for these girls that are having babies, how are we reaching them to provide them effective birth control? Because the experiences that I have had is these young women are not going to the pharmacy to get the pill. And I know there was a study done several years ago at McGee Women's Hospital in Pittsburgh about the effectiveness of IUDs with teens immediately post-delivery.
Sure.
Because some of these young women aren't even going to their postpartum follow-up.
Leanne,
their babies and moving on.
Two good points. We're up against the clock. Thank you so much for the telephone call. Let's take that first point, Mary Ott. Kids are exploring in different ways, and there are consequences for the different ways of exploration. Could you address some of that? We're not talking straight sex in some cases.
No, I think Leanne actually made a really great point, that we as providers and as parents, as parents, not just talk about sex as if it's a monolithic thing.
Sure.
I mean, we need to think about different types of sex, oral sex, vaginal sex, anal sex. We need to be sensitive to sexual minority youth. And I think being careful about how we ask them, I tend to ask kids really broadly, what types of things are you doing sexually? When I talk to them, I ask them, do they have male partners or female partners? Are they attracted to men, to women, to both, to neither? Sort of getting a sense of what their sexual orientation is, what types of relationships that they've had, and what types of sexual behaviors they've had. Because then as a pediatrician, I can help them if I sort of know, sort of where they're at. So I think Leanne makes a really important point. I mean, it also goes to this piece of healthy relationships and thinking really broadly about healthy relationships instead of vaginal sex, yes, no, thinking about sex as sort of a range of behaviors that can happen within a relationship.
Okay, and the second part of Leanne's question, Ann Teitelman, we addressed this a little bit earlier in the show. For the young woman, the teenager who's given birth, moving forward, how do you reach out to that young woman? In which direction do you point her? What do you tell her?
Well, it's a good point that Leanne brings up, because about 17% of teen births are repeat births. So this is a big problem. And she's right that one of the ways we can do that is to offer long-acting contraceptives at the time of delivery. But in many cases, that's not covered by insurance. So state by state, we need to make sure that those types of LARCs, as they're called, are available, covered by insurance. And also, there's these home visiting programs that see teen moms before delivery and after, and those are nice, very evidence-based programs that support young women as they go through that transition.
Okay, Ann Teitelman, Associate Professor of Nursing at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing. Thanks so much for joining us on Radio Times.
Sure, thank you.
And Mary Ott, Associate Professor of Pediatrics and Adolescent Medicine at Indiana University School of Medicine. We appreciate your time here at Radio Times.
Thanks, Mary. Thanks for having me on.
Also, don't forget to check out our Facebook page and podcasts at whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Kevin Griffin. Our producers, Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Aaron. Sinclair Moran is our intern. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain on Radio Times. Thanks for joining us.